Okay, great. So this is the 25th, right, of July, 2012, Emmerich Hansen. And I'd like to explore with you this recurring teaching of the Buddha, which essentially boiled down to three words: gratification, danger, and escape. So in his own journey, as a beginning monastic, 7 years later, culminating in his complete and irrevocable awakening, which I think crystal clear factually occurred, during that journey, he talked about it fairly often, his own lessons, his own process, his own struggles, and his own steps on his path to awakening. So tracking some of his steps, very human, without resort to any supernatural powers, unlike any other founder of a major religion, if we want to think of Buddhism in that way. So as we track his own steps, in which he was training and purifying and transforming his mind, his heart, his body, which means, therefore, fundamentally transforming his own nervous system, his own body chemistry. Well, as he was taking those steps, we can walk in his footsteps ourselves in some real way. That's his invitation. It's as if he went the whole way on the journey and then turned around and beckoned the rest of us to walk in his footsteps and pointed out what that path was. It's a very human process, and I think bringing it down to earth and getting a sense of the possibility of it, rather than some sort of daunting, you know, people in a cave for 20 years sort of deal, is very important for us. It gives confidence, and it's motivating. It gives us a sense of what's possible, and it honors and respects our own efforts, in some real sense, I think, heroic. They go against the stream of the conventional world in a lot of ways, don't they? And it takes some real effort to keep swimming against those currents. So, on his journey, he talked about, again and again, what he called the gratification, the danger, and the escape. And so I'd like to talk tonight about what that is, fairly succinctly, and then in particular, focus on the escape, all right? The good news. And I want to talk about the escape in two ways that are conditional, and then the ultimate unconditional escape. Okay. So what's the gratification? He spoke again and again of the world, which he really means is the world of experiential phenomena. So right now, we all see sights, we hear sounds, we feel sensations in the body, right? We taste tastes, including no taste or a nothing taste. We smell smells, and in particular, we think thoughts. Those are the six sense bases in Buddhist psychology, and that's the whole kit and caboodle, basically, in Buddhist psychology. That's the world as we know it. A material world is presumed that lies beyond our senses, but we never know it directly. We only know our own phenomenology, our own experience. Okay. In this world, there are many gratifications, aren't there? There are real gratifications. Some of them are very wholesome. Feeling love, feeling loved. The beauty of this room. The beauty of a sunset. The feeling in our body when we're out in nature. A sense of progress. Playing a good game of ping pong and winning. Playing a really good game of ping pong and being beaten by your kid and being so happy that your kid legitimately beat you. All right, loving it when your kid finally beats you at chess, whatever. You know, there are many kinds of very wholesome gratifications, aren't there, in this world. It's a beautiful, it's great, it's perfectly fine. There are also some that are less wholesome, right? The short-term gratification of getting angry at somebody. Or just kind of going into our case about someone and thinking to ourselves, what a great case that is. You know, our resentful, angry, fault-finding, finger-pointing case. Right? There are other kinds of gratifications, aren't there? And there even are subtle gratifications in a sense of making ourselves feel like we exist. We're solid. We're going on being. So the Buddha acknowledged these gratifications. They're real. But then there's a danger. What's the danger? What's the danger? The danger, in his view, is that these gratifications feed a process of craving. that is not worth the price, that is not worth the rewards of the gratifications. The trick is to see through the process of craving for what's pleasant or craving the ending of what's unpleasant so that we can simply rest in and appreciate the wholesome gratification streaming through us without essentializing them and turning them into things that we then try to hold on to. That's the middle way. That stands against in effect, aversive war with their gratifications, which was the ascetic tradition that the Buddha initially trained in his own personal journey, and then turned his back on by saying, that's not the true path to complete freedom and complete happiness. Right? So that, and we know the danger in lots of ways, right? We're chasing after things, we're holding on to things, we're attached to our position, we're making we're getting kind of obsessed about what we want, and then we get disappointed when it's not as good as what we want. We assume we're going to get something is going to happen, and it doesn't happen the way we like. Right? These are the various dangers, the suffering, and then of course we create harms. We pursue our own gratifications. We harm others in various ways. These are the dangers. I don't think we need to talk a lot about the dangers. They're pretty clear, aren't they? So then the question is, what's the escape? So that's what I particularly want to talk about and then kind of explore it with you. I think of the escape in a sense, two levels, that are three levels really, conditional, maha conditional or mega conditional, and then unconditional altogether. Okay. So one primary way to escape the trap, it's kind of a trap. It's a baited trap. One way to escape the trap of craving gratifications is to feel in some deep way that there's no basis for craving because our deepest needs are already met. You may recall in the meditation, I emphasized in three steps feeling already all right now, so we're unthreatened. So therefore, we can truly afford to be at peace. We don't have to grasp after or construct fear or anger. We don't have to have an aversive reaction to what's happening because we're basically okay. And so helping ourselves in the body, relax some, undo the evolutionary whispering in the back of the ear or quiet it or understand it that says, be afraid, be very afraid. They're about to get you, watch out, undoing that, right? Dropping over time our war with others, because when we're at war with them, we are creating a context in which we're giving them cause to fear us, which always gives us cause to fear them. That's an important way right there to help, if you will, the reptile layer of the brain to kind of calm down, chill out, and not get so caught up in craving. A second way is to feel that there's a fullness in this moment. There's a quality of gladness and gratitude with things as they are. There's a contentment with things as they are. So there's not a basis there for craving what's pleasant. We're already fed. We're already full. Sure, it'd be nice to have $1 million more or $1 million at all. It'd be nice to have any money at all. It'd be nice to have whatever, right? But there's a basic sense of all rightness so that we're in balance. We're not always leaning forward into life trying to grab the next thing for ourselves. That undoes the gratification and the danger. And then the third thing, particularly for us, the most social species on the planet, is to feel fundamentally loved and loving already. So when we're basically grounded in that sense of the all rightness, we're not at war, we don't have to defend, we don't have to have an aversive reaction to anything, a reaction of hatred in Buddhist terminology, Second, when we're a basic sense of fullness and fedness and enoughness, we notice there's enough air to breathe. You know, we're grounded in kind of the miracle of being alive at all. Then we're not greedy. We're not caught up again in traditional language in greed. And also when we feel loved and loving, we're not caught up in the third great poison of heartache, broadly defined. That's the first level. That's a major way to escape from the danger. Because when we're in that state of mind, what do you like when you're in that basic state of mind in which you don't feel threatened or frustrated or rejected and lonely? You default to a natural sense of peacefulness, happiness, and love. The body is being refueled and repaired. There's an ease. There's an engagement with life, but not on the basis of craving that leads to suffering and harm. In other words, because the need is met, there's no reaching to meet the need. And with time and practice, since neurons that fire together wire together, we embed, we internalize, we encode these momentary states of mind in which we feel basically peaceful, happy, and loving, and we increasingly turn them into traits woven into our being, which we take with us wherever we go. It's kind of like the great turtle shell, in a sense. So far, so good? Okay. So I think what's beautiful about that, you may have heard me talk about it, and the more I talk about it, the more it just seems to me to be wonderfully true. It goes to the Tibetan saying, take the fruit as the path. If the aim of a good life in many ways is to be fundamentally, if not even profoundly peaceful, profoundly happy, profoundly loving, what's fantastic is that's an incredible method. You know, if that's the end of life, that's of a good life, that's the means, in a sense, of the holy life. So every minute we spend in basic peacefulness, happiness, and love deepens it in ourselves, and we become more and more rooted and less inclined toward the craving, you know, of hatred, greed, and heartache that leads to suffering. The second conditional way to escape, I call it the Maha way, is to open out into spacious awareness. We may not feel peacefulness, happiness, and love. There may be a lot of hatred, greed, or heartache, broadly defined, one form or another arising, but we're stepped out of it. We're stepped out of that movie, sitting 20 rows back, eating our popcorn, going, whoa, bummer, dude, you know, or whatever. We're out of it. That's radically out of it. We can always go there. That's why I say it's the Maha one. It's conditional. You have to construct the conditions of open awareness, disidentified, observing ego, choice, open awareness, okay, where you're pulled out. You have to construct that. It's conditioned. It's caused, right? We cause it. But it's less conditional than the first level I was talking about, where you feel basically like your needs are met in your experience. You experience a basic need meeting. So the motivational systems that are absolutely innate to us don't get activated into hatred, greed, and heartache. Okay? That's the more conditional one. The less conditional one, still conditional, is to pop out into open awareness, where we're simply mindful of it. Okay? Now, yeah, where we're simply aware. So far, so good? That's a radical method, just to be able to do that. Wow, instant impact. We cultivate our capacity in here and also informally, but it's a fantastic resort. Okay. And then there's the unconditional one. And this is the one that's hard to talk about. This is the one where, as the Buddha put it, one finds the stillness amidst movement. One finds that which is unconditioned eternally prior to conditioned emergent appearances. And, quote, in that my mind delights. That's what he said. In that my mind delights. That's where I found my island. He used the metaphor of an island in the stream of changes, many of which lead to suffering and harm. I found an island, that which doesn't change at all. And as soon as you think about the unconditioned, you turn it into a conditioned idea, right? As soon as we language it, we turn it into a thing. But it's kind of funny. In any moment, basically, you can kind of intuit that it's there. It's like you look over your shoulder almost. You see it quickly, and then almost as soon as you see it, the seeing of it pulls you out of it. But there's almost like there's an intuitive memory of its reality and truth. So we increasingly recognize, for example, that all experience, including the experience of mindfulness, including the experience of awareness, you know, the second, maha, conditional escape, even that is fleeting, insubstantial, can't hold on to it, not a reliable basis for deep happiness. Even subtle, profound experiences of mindfulness or awareness, all experienced categorically. In other words, the first level of escape is to understand specific experiences and what happens with them. The maha conditional level is to step out into awareness itself, okay, which is still a kind of experience. It's still a constructed, conditioned mental phenomenon. The third level of escape is to realize that any experience at all is not the place to take our home. There's kind of a radical renunciate quality there. You're still engaged with the world. You're still engaged with experiencing. You wish for yourself wholesome and pleasant abiding, just like you would wish that for a friend. But always there's a knowing, a kind of disenchantment about experience itself. It's really quite hard to talk about the unconditioned, you know. But it's real, it's there. Reason alone can tell you that there has to be some kind of emptiness just prior to the somethingness present in each instant, which is then gone as soon as you're aware of it. So intellect can tell you, or intuition can let you know. And as you may know, having been here a bit, you know, the last period of time, to some extent thematically, I've been focusing on emptiness. And I've talked about emptiness as a technical term in Buddhism that it's misunderstood, I think, fairly often, partly because it has two meanings, basically. You know, one meaning is that it's simply an attribute of experience. You know, experience and also material phenomena are compounded, they're built up with many parts, they're transient, and they arise dependently. The more radical meaning of emptiness is it's not a void, in a sense, but it's the unconditioned prior to the emergence of any form. So what I'm talking about here, to connect it to other things I've talked about, is a growing intuition of that second kind of emptiness. The danger is to turn that second kind of emptiness, to reify it, to essentialize it, to turn it into a thing. There's a danger there. That's why the Buddha was very reluctant to say very much at all about the unconditioned. He mostly talked about it in negations. It's not this, it's not that. You know, more than anything else, it's for us to sense and intuit and to rest our mind in so that we delight in it. Okay. What do you think about all this? The gratification, the danger, and the escape. And then one way to make your escape, which is to feel that there's no basis for craving in a kind of ordinary sense. A more radical way, one that's even more available to us, is even if we're kind of caught up in craving or we're upset about things or we're grasping after things, the mind's disturbed, still we can pop out of the whole frame and just observe it, right? And then even more radically, we can kind of have some intuition or a knowing of that which is unconditioned prior to the whole shebang. I'm thinking of Steve McQueen in the movie The Great Escape, you know, but anyway, riding his motorcycle out of the prison camp in World War II. Okay, what do you think? Try to make it real for yourself. What in the world am I talking about?
Well, Rick, I have to admit, the third one, I don't understand. I mean, The first one, I sort of understand, because that's kind of like being, you know, being content, kind of like when you're meditating, just being content with the moment.
Yeah, you're already chill.
Okay, the second one, you're stepping out and you're observing that.
Yeah. Do you understand it intellectually at all?
I don't get it at all. I mean, maybe I'm the only
one, but... No, you're far from.
I don't get the third one at all.
Yeah, the Buddha used words like the deathless.
I mean, is it equanimity with, kind of an equanimity with everything?
In his language, I'll tell you what he said a couple times, and this is a big one to really wrap our minds around, but, you know, I hope I'm not being a jerk about it, but... I just don't want to water down, in a sense. You know, I feel like I was, and so I just think it's disrespectful to not say, well, he did talk about this, you know, and it's real for me personally. And I can read people, and you can sense their transmission. It's real for them, too. And you can sense that. There are people, I consider them, for me, it's a little bit, a metaphor that works for me is how transparent is the window to the unconditioned, right?
I guess I don't know what the unconditioned.
Yeah. Well, some people you look into their eyes and it just feels like whoosh, you've fallen into a deep pool. You know, that maybe is a way of talking about it. And so what I mean by it, he said basically there are four realities. This might be one way to think about it. There's the reality of materiality. There's the reality of the ordinary mind. There's the reality of the sort of various cosmic realms, the God realms, whatever. Okay, the heavens, multiple. And then there's the realm of Nibbana. So it's interesting for him to talk about that as a fourth kind of reality. It's interesting. Another way I think about it that helps me a lot is to think of the unconditioned as what is happening, in a sense, and happening is not the right word, but what is there just prior to anything happening? The other thing I want to say about this is that, you know, there's a classic line, those who know do not speak, you know, and I want to heed their wisdom too. I think a lot of it is, it's not about over-intellectualizing, it's about intuiting. You know, it's like if your body gets the shivers, it's almost like there's an intuition of a stillness. Yeah, that's transcendentally, it's woven into, but somehow it's other than this busy, busy world, including the world of the mind. I think the poets, the artists, you know, I'm not feeling very eloquent tonight, although I just feel crystal clear, it's there, it's real, and it's our ultimate resort. And I think a lot what enlightenment is to be radically grounded in it, so that no matter what happens, you're grounded in the unconditioned, even as you live in this world. Oh, I see hands. Great.
Rick, I was just wondering if you could comment on how this state relates to love.
Well, that's a very interesting thing. You know, if you look historically at people who seem just radically awash in the unconditioned, now the way people talk about it seems culturally determined. Some people speak of it in a more theistic way. God consciousness, God identification, God realization, you know, thou art that. That's the traditional Vedanta formulation. Atman is Brahma, right? The soul is the divine. Other people, Native Americans or indigenous peoples worldwide, let's say, will speak of it in a different way. The Buddha used his own languaging, I think partly because he deliberately did not use heavily theistically weighted language, partly because he was speaking in some ways against or carving out distinctions from the stream that he was already in. And I think also because he was just a badass teacher who was always yanking the carpet underneath people whenever they would cling to something, including their ideas, you know, of the divine. So when that said, worldwide, consider these people. They vary in their personalities, right? But what seems universally said about them, man, woman, householder, or monastic, different traditions around the world, they all seem radiantly awake and profoundly virtuous, and including loving, profoundly loving, which is really cool, you know? And we could think about why that is a little bit, but I think my three words, you know, peaceful, happy, and loving, they're profoundly peaceful. They're undisturbed by what happens. They're profoundly happy, the highest happiness, and they're profoundly loving, you know? So that, more subtly, if you will, and again, I don't want to intellectualize about it, I'll just name it in passing. Routinely, people talk about the two fundamental qualities of the unconditioned, whether they speak of it in a more theistic way, a more God-oriented way, or they don't use that language still. They talk about the quality of consciousness, wakefulness, awareness, and a quality of benevolence, kindness, compassion, love. Innate. And I myself have wondered, like, why would consciousness, I can understand why consciousness would need to be woven into the fabric of materiality for it to manifest because of the nature of quantum phenomena. Why would that consciousness be benevolent or benign or loving? It seems to be. And I wonder if there's something about it in which it just kind of seems to lean in, you know, to reality. But other than that, it's above my pay grade, and those who speak do not know. Yeah.
I have kind of a thought around it. Think about love, like, usually we have the most love from those who are closest to us, our children, partners, that kind of a thing. And I think in some ways, like, with the people that are like along the path that I've met, is that they have a real concept of that space, that they are the chair, they are the other person, they are the thought themselves, they are the thinker, they are the, you know, the and everyone else is also that in themselves, and so that they're so open-minded. Their mind is everybody, and everybody is their mind, you know, that there's kind of goes along with an open-heartedness.
Oh, great.
That's
absolutely true.
You know,
yeah.
If that makes sense.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's my experience too, yeah.
Something along those same lines with both of you that was striking me is that I think acceptance is a real key to that unconditionality to me, because what I'm hearing is that that releases that craving, that desire to try and create change, or that something needs to be fixed, and it's about accepting that everybody for who they are, and that we are all connected, like you're kind of referencing that we are all part of the same consciousness. And to me, that level creates a sense of peace, I think.
Yeah.
And something you were talking about, that I know for myself, I studied Native American topology for spirituality, and they reference it as the void, I think, a lot of times, which is, again, that space of infinite potentiality before anything has manifest. And within that, there's that a great sense of calm and peace and understanding, and there's not an agenda attached to it. So that's something that helps me kind of work with that.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate that. And I'm reflecting on how, basically, to bring it really close to our experience, the Buddha's teaching, see for yourself, is that if we rely upon things that are changing for our happiness, we'll be disappointed. ultimately, you know, the five great reflections, right, in Tibetan Buddhism, here are the questions, you may have heard them. Is it given to me to avoid aging? Is it given to me to avoid illness? Is it given to me to avoid death? Is it given to me to avoid being separated one day, one way or another, from everything I love? Is it given to me to avoid inheriting the results of my actions, for better or worse? That's right at the heart of what I'm trying to talk about tonight, you know, that what's the alternative? I mean, it's interesting, the Buddha didn't leave us with the two noble truths, suffering and craving. We're screwed. You know, he didn't stop there. He said, yes, it's radically true that there's no ultimate happiness, there's no ultimate freedom or fulfillment in relying upon that which endlessly changes, that which is endlessly conditioned. Things change because they're conditioned. They arise due to conditions. That which is subject to arising due to conditions is subject to passing away due to conditions. Every coming together is followed by a coming apart. That's the Buddha. We cannot find our ultimate freedom in changing conditions. His own steps on his path that he then invites us to walk was an attempt to find ultimate happiness in increasingly refined conditions. He tried to find them as a party boy prince, in effect. It wasn't there. He couldn't find them there. He walked away from all that. Okay. He practiced various asceticisms and mental trainings. He had all kinds of mystical experiences. Those too were conditioned experiences. They passed away because they arose due to conditions. They passed away. They were not reliable. They slipped through his fingers. It's kind of like he's saying as he walks down his path, I tried that one. Didn't work. Tried the next one, even more subtle and groovier. Didn't work. I even tried this one. Really intense mystical experiences. That didn't work either. Because they arose due to conditions, they always passed away. And then one night on the full moon, the Bodhi tree, he found that which does not pass away. That which is unconditioned. Does not arise due to conditions, does not pass away due to conditions. So that's the context in which we're exploring here, the ultimate escape. Yeah, you asked, I'll just repeat it a little louder, is that a non-ordinary consciousness? That's a very interesting question. People talk about that. And it seems that the body-mind is conditioned, right? Mental phenomena are conditioned, neural phenomena are conditioned. It seems as if people can have intuitions of what's unconditioned. So routinely, in a subtle way, that can actually grow without it being some kind of radical revelation. We can have a growing sense of the stillness in which everything moves. Some, you know, it's like words fail us. Maybe that for a person that it's meaningful to think of that as some kind of, in a theistic way, as some kind of divinity. So we can have those even without some kind of nirvana experience. It does seem, though, that when people go through these radical awakenings, that many people are irrevocably changed. And so I think I had a friend, he's a teacher in Hawaii, Steve Armstrong. I asked him once, you know, what nirvana, about nirvana. And You may have heard me use this metaphor. He said it's like basically you live your life in a valley and you see up there these tall mountains and you practice and practice and you try to climb up out of your valley so you can see more broadly, you know, kind of get out of the frame. We're trapped in the conditioned. You can feel the subtle tension and almost a subtle sorrow we feel in our bones somehow, you know, which again to me is data of sorts, that there's some profound knowing in us of an unconditioned, almost as if that's really our true home. So you want to climb up out of the mountains, out of the valley rather. You work your way up the trail, and then someday, somehow, you find yourself on the tallest peak. And in Buddhism, it's the what's called cessation. Just, I think neurologically, if you want to read my essay called Eddies in the Stream, I talk about this. What might be happening in the brain in the classic description in Buddhism of moving through the first four jhanas and then the formless jhanas ending up with neither perception nor non-perception and then cessation, that's the classical description. What that might be, I think minimally, since the mind is profoundly quiet, the brain's got to be profoundly quiet as well. So there you are atop the mountain, but it's, and when you're there, you know, you can see things in a radically different way. And then, but you can't live up there, is what Steve said. You can't stay there. Nobody stays in Nibbana that I know of. I mean, I think it's very interesting to think about people who are radical saints. They just are just awash in the divine. And they're kind of, you know, they're hard to take care of. You got to take care of them because they don't, they're like, maybe they're awash in Nibbana. You may have heard me talk about the story of the Bahia Sutta. Bahia was awakened and then he was soon after gored by a bull. Like he was kind of out of touch. So you just can't function. This is a conditioned world. So, you know, but as Steve said, when you come back, your view is ever after radically changed. You know something, you know, that you carry with you forever after. And I think part of it is what you carry with you forever after a kind of a radical disengagement from the contents of your mind, the ordinary conditioned stream. You just, it's there, it's present. You'd rather have it be a pleasant day than an unpleasant one. But at the end of the day, you just know it's coming and going and it's not your true home. You know, it's kind of like you're hanging in your true home and the in-laws are visiting. Being the ordinary mind. Okay, nothing wrong with the in-laws. Well, So I think, just to wrap, you know, honor your own moments of sensing or knowing of the unconditioned. Or the maha-conditioned mindfulness, or ordinary moments of peacefulness, happiness, and love. They're all good. They're all on the path. They're all wholesome. So let's just hang out with this for a minute or so. It's another way to talk about Buddha nature. That Buddha meaning wakefulness, profound knowing. even as there are conditioned phenomena, there's always what's unconditioned. And even as there's just the ordinary stream of the mind, including, you know, reactions and upsets and aggravations, you know, as they say in Tibet, behind the obscurations, there is our true nature, our Buddha nature, always already present. It's a little bit like abiding in a kind of stillness or happiness, sitting on your sofa, watching people be upset on TV. TV is your mind, right? It's wonderful to know that you can always find the couch. Thank you for your goodness. That's another thing to take resort in, knowing your true goodness. Thank you. Have a good week.